All of this is important because there has been a resurrection of Burns-type positions in the current debate about the cause of higher inflation rates. Senator Elizabeth Warren blames the rising inflation on greedy corporations raising their prices. Others have blamed rising prices on the greater prevalence of monopolies. Antitrust is apparently an anti-inflation tool. Make no mistake, these ideas are wrong. A belief that greed is responsible for inflation requires a belief that firms waited 40 years to collectively and simultaneously raise prices, an amazing level of planning and discipline. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We've got a little report, article thing. Still don't know what to call this. It's a policy brief. It says it right here at the top. From the Mercatus Center, George Mason University, by Joshua R. Hendrickson. And it's titled, Central Banks Are Inflation Creators, Not Inflation Fighters. Now, I don't, and I talk about this a little bit in the guy's take, but I don't completely agree with the premise or everything laid out in how this is argued, but I think it's incredibly valuable to understand the perspective and dig into what was happening in the 70s and the 80s and the Volcker period, because it looks like Powell right now is trying to pull a Volcker and getting really aggressive about the monetary policy. And we're seeing all of these drummed up old arguments of like, oh, the Federal Reserve is fighting inflation and what should the policy decisions be and how to move forward, et cetera, et cetera. And I think most of it misses the fundamental realities of monetary inflation, and constantly again conflate price inflation with monetary inflation, which we've talked about a number of times, but I'll briefly go over it again at the end of the episode. But ultimately, a lot of this stuff can be very difficult to navigate and very difficult to make sense of, especially when some of the premises of the argument are wrong. It's hard to identify and know when that is the case and how to be able to pinpoint that that's exactly what's happening. So I don't want to lead the discussion too much. We are going to go ahead and get into our read for the day. It's not very long, and then we will jump into a guy's take. Really quick, I want to thank our sponsors. If you are looking for a no-nonsense best way to get onboarded into Bitcoin, then you need to look no further than Swan Bitcoin. And don't forget to check out their app. They have the simplest way to manage and stay on top of things and keep informed. And they've got a really great article. In fact, I'm probably going to read it on the show. Bitcoin, it's winning, or it's time for winning, from Corey. Check it out. That one will be coming soon. But go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. Then another brilliant way to stack Bitcoin is to do it for free with a fiat debit card that pays you sats back on everything you buy. I have now over 17.5 million sats just from the time that I've been using Fold. I pay $10 a month for the premium debit card. I run everything through it. All of my purchases, my bills, everything. I've got almost $4,000 worth of Bitcoin in sats back. There is no lower cost way to have an ongoing regular stack that you can build up over time. And you can start just by checking out the app for free. You get 50,000 sats. GuySwan.com/fold. And then you need a place to keep all of these sats safe. You need the coldest of cold storage. You need primo security, Bitcoin only, default air gapped hardware wallet. You need the cold card. And luckily, you can get 9% off. I lied yesterday and said it was 10%. It is 9% off with my discount code, Bitcoin Audible. You can find the link and everything in the show notes. Now, with that, now that you have your Bitcoin stack, you have your debit card that's paying you in sats every single day, and you know where to keep it all safe on your cold card, let's get in to today's read. And it's titled, Central Banks Are Inflation Creators, Not Inflation Fighters, by Joshua R. Hendrickson. Over the past 50 years, economists have spilled a lot of ink studying and debating periods of high inflation that began in the late 1960s, continued throughout the 1970s, and ended with the disinflation of the early 1980s. Although any particular contribution to the inflation debate of the 1970s often involved technical details about monetary policy and economic models, the debate was actually about something bigger and more fundamental. Who is responsible for inflation? Put differently, if one analogizes inflation to a fire, is the central bank the arsonist or the firefighter? The answer is that central banks are the arsonist. Central banks are inflation creators, not inflation fighters. Unfortunately, even today, many economists do not seem to recognize that the debate was about these questions. Even many of those who now recognize that the Federal Reserve was able to bring about lower inflation in the early 1980s are prone to answer these questions incorrectly. They falsely attribute the disinflation to the Federal Reserve, simply becoming a better inflation fighter. Now that the United States is experiencing the highest inflation rates of the past 40 years, it is important to revisit the lessons of these debates. During the rising inflation of the late 1960s and the 1970s, monetarists argued that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Inflation, according to the monetarists, was caused by an excess supply of money. By contrast, chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, Arthur Burns, and those of a similar mindset, were convinced that inflation is caused by external cost-push factors. As early as 1970, Arthur Burns was arguing in speeches that, quote, "Monetary and fiscal tools are inadequate for dealing with sources of price inflation such as are plaguing us now, that is, pressures on costs arising from excessive wage increases." Alan Meltzer notes that Burns tended to blame inflation on labor unions and monopolies. As a result, Burns was convinced that monetary policy is not the most effective tool for reducing inflation. In fact, in a November 1970 entry in his diary, Burns writes, quote,
"What the boys that swarm around the White House fail to see is that the country now faces an entirely new problem, namely a sizable inflation in the midst of recession, that classical remedies for fighting inflation or recession will simply not do, that new medicine is needed for the new illness."
That new medicine refers to wage and price controls. If anything could summarize Arthur Burns' tenure at the Federal Reserve, it was the mantra that this time is different. In 1971, Burns echoed the sentiment from his diary when he told the Joint Economic Committee that the rules of economics are not working in quite the way they used to. Milton Friedman mockingly retorted that, "Whatever may be true about the economy, the propensity of economists to appeal to a change in our economic structure whenever they are puzzled works quite the way that it used to." He similarly noted that medicine that had been given to treat this illness worked exactly the way that an economist would expect. The problem was not that the illness was new, but rather that the patient had been given the wrong medicine. Burns' idea that inflation could not be reduced through monetary policy, or at least monetary policy alone, was ultimately proven wrong by the Volcker disinflation and the corresponding overhaul of Federal Reserve doctrine. Economist Robert Hetzel describes the change in monetary policy ushered in by Paul Volcker.
"Under Volcker, as a result of a focus on expected inflation, the Federal Open Market Committee simply accepted responsibility for inflation without regard to its presumed origin, as aggregate demand or cost push. The desire to establish the credibility required to control expected inflation imposed overall consistency on monetary policy. The demonstrated ability of monetary policy not only to control inflation, but also to do so without periodic recourse to, quote, high unemployment, gave credence to the idea that the central bank could control inflation through consistent application of policy thought of as a strategy."
In other words, the Federal Reserve accepted responsibility for inflation rather than viewing inflation as an external factor it needed to fight. All of this is important because there has been a resurrection of Burns-type positions in the current debate about the cause of higher inflation rates. Senator Elizabeth Warren blames the rising inflation on greedy corporations raising their prices. Others have blamed rising prices on the greater prevalence of monopolies. Antitrust is apparently an anti-inflation tool. Make no mistake, these ideas are wrong. A belief that greed is responsible for inflation requires a belief that firms waited 40 years to collectively and simultaneously raise prices, an amazing level of planning and discipline. In addition, no serious person believes that antitrust enforcement will bring about lower rates of inflation. More broadly, this argument is like the blaming of tariffs for high prices. To the extent that either of these arguments has merit, they confuse relative price changes and possibly changes in the price level with changes in the rate of inflation. Regardless of these ideas' weaknesses, the revitalization of these ideas is an indication that the important lesson from the 1970s might not have been learned. These arguments are part of a broader debate about the nature of monetary policy and inflation that spans decades. As Hetzel has repeatedly noted throughout his career studying monetary policy, the fundamental debates about inflation are really concerned with whether the central bank is an inflation creator or an inflation fighter. The inflation creator view entails that if inflation is too high, it is because monetary policy is too loose, and if inflation is too low, it is because monetary policy is too tight. Some think about this in terms of the quantity theory of money. An excess supply of money causes inflation. An excess demand for money causes disinflation and even deflation. Others think about this in terms of interest rates. If inflation is high, it is because the central bank has set the bank policy rate below the natural rate, i.e. the rate that would prevail in a competitive market in a frictionless world. If inflation is low, it is because the central bank has set the bank policy rate above the natural rate. According to the inflation fighter view of central banking, the responsibility of monetary policymakers is to adequately respond to inflation. Those who see the central bank as an inflation fighter must therefore believe that inflation has some source other than the central bank, that it has non-monetary factors. According to this view, economic shocks cause macroeconomic variables such as inflation to move around. The job of the central bank is to adjust its policy in response to these shocks. The two views overlap somewhat. For example, people who see the central bank as the creator of inflation would acknowledge that many factors other than the money supply or the central bank's policy rate affect the price level and inflation. However, they would argue that the extent to which these factors affect nominal variables is entirely determined by the central bank. In other words, those who advocate the inflation creator view argue that any deviation of inflation from the target rate of inflation is a failure of the central bank. The failure might be active in the sense that the central bank increases or decreases the money supply too much relative to changes in money demand. Alternatively, the failure might be passive in the sense that the central bank fails to adjust its policy in response to market conditions, resulting in adverse outcomes. Either way, a central banker who pursues monetary policy that is expected to result in inflation above or below target should be fired. Thus, the two views differ not on the sources of the shocks that affect the macroeconomy. Rather, they differ on whether deviations of inflation from the central bank's target or from its long-term average are non-monetary in nature, and possibly beyond the control of the central bank. Those who view the central bank as an inflation fighter believe that inflation becomes high or low because something unexpected happened. This view is evident in Figure 1, which is similar to a figure recently published by the President's Council of Economic Advisers, or CEA. Figure 1 clearly articulates the inflation fighter view of the central bank and demonstrates the CEA's belief that external shocks explain fluctuations in the inflation rate. The COVID-19 lockdowns and reopenings are only the latest such shocks. The problem with the CEA's belief is that such figures are simply a plot with the time series of the inflation rate. An economist cannot assess the role of policy by simply looking at the time series evidence. Economists are interested in the counterfactual. Counterfactuals are difficult. A counterfactual requires comparing what happened to what would have happened. Because one does not know what would have happened, one needs economic models, concepts, and analysis. A prime example of the importance of counterfactuals is the concept of a monetary policy offset. This idea has been made popular in recent years by economist Scott Sumner. The idea is that central banks tend to respond to higher than expected inflation by tightening monetary policy. For example, suppose the government decides to embark on expansionary fiscal policy. All else equal, this policy would tend to increase aggregate demand. One would expect output and prices to rise. However, because the central bank would also expect output and prices to rise, it would tighten monetary policy to prevent prices from rising. The net result is that expansionary fiscal policy has little to no effect on economic activity and inflation when one looks at the time series. In other words, even if the marginal effect of fiscal policy is large, the contractionary monetary policy offsets those effects such that, upon casual inspection of the data, fiscal policy would appear not to matter. This point is important. What one observes in the time series is what happened. One does not know what would have happened, and economists can offer guidance here. Wars are typical examples of expansionary fiscal policy. As a result, a central banker trying to maintain a particular rate of inflation would be expected to offset these expansionary effects. Two of the episodes shown in Figure 1 involve wars, yet there is no evidence of monetary offset. One can blame inflation on these events only by admitting that the central bank failed to counteract these increases in demand and permitted prices to rise. In looking at the period in Figure 1 labeled Episode 3, the late 1960s expansion, the CEA infers that inflation was caused by a booming economy. Again, this view assumes that inflation just sort of happens. There is a lot of economic activity, and so prices go up. But what is the source of this increase in economic activity? Introductory macroeconomics holds that supply-driven booms result in lower inflation, whereas demand-driven booms result in higher inflation. Because monetary policy works through aggregate demand, this approach raises the question as to why the rising inflation brought about by this boom was beyond the Federal Reserve's control. Also, as Figure 1 shows, the 1970s was a period of significant oil price shocks. However, supply shocks tend to reduce real economic output and increase prices. Thus, if the rising prices were really driven by supply shocks, such as sudden spikes in oil prices, then one would not expect to observe much of a change in the nominal value of economic activity, i.e., the product of real economic output and the price level. Yet the 1970s witnessed a higher average growth rate of nominal GDP. This growth rate indicates that monetary policy played a role in these high rates of inflation. The CEA further points to higher gasoline prices in the period just before the Great Recession. However, it is unclear that these higher gasoline prices were driven by supply-side changes. Some evidence suggests that gasoline prices increased because of the economic growth experienced in many developing countries. It is unclear why an increase in the relative price of gasoline would be the cause of higher inflation. After all, there is a difference between accounting and economics. Finally, Figure 1 is notable for what it lacks. The dramatic reduction in inflation in the early 1980s was brought about by the Federal Reserve, led by Paul Volcker. The change in policy, as mentioned earlier, was that the Federal Reserve took responsibility for inflation and contracted monetary policy to bring about this disinflation. Another detail missing from interpretations like that of the CEA is one of the most significant mistakes made in monetary policy in the post-war era. I am referring to the dramatic decline in the money supply that resulted in a short period of deflation in 2008. The Volcker policy change and the deflation of 2008 bookend a long period of low, stable inflation. Figure 1 leaves one with the impression that this period was simply a quarter century of good luck for the central bank. Whether it is this explicit intention or not, figures like Figure 1 are meant to communicate the idea that the central bank is an inflation fighter. That inflation occurs for reasons that have little or nothing to do with the actions of the central bank, and that monetary policymakers do the best they can. But these external factors can cause significant deviations of inflation from what the central bank would prefer. In addition, this view even suggests that monetary policy might be ill-equipped to deal with particular causes of inflation. This suggestion opens the door to all sorts of alternative policy responses, many of which have been historical failures. The lesson of the 1970s and the subsequent disinflation of the early 1980s favors the inflation creator view of central banks. Although some might argue that the Federal Reserve simply improved at fighting inflation, this conclusion is refuted by the evidence. This argument is certainly made by some economists, such as Richard Clarida, Jordi Galli, and Mark Gertler. They estimate monetary feedback rules that measure the responsiveness of the Federal Reserve's intermediate target, the federal funds rate, to inflation and the output gap. They find that the Federal Reserve was much more responsive to inflation in the post-Volcker era. In addition, they use a theoretical model to show that their estimates for the pre-Volcker period result in a world of multiple equilibria. However, the flaw in their analysis is that they are using the data that are available today to evaluate these periods. To properly analyze policy using this method, one needs to use the data that were available to the Federal Reserve at the time the decisions were made. Athanasios Orfanidis performs this sort of analysis and shows that the responsiveness of the Federal Reserve's intermediate target to inflation during the pre-Volcker period was not much different than that of the post-Volcker period. Thus, it cannot simply be that the Federal Reserve was a better inflation fighter after the 1970s. By contrast, the inflation creator view, most notably advocated by monetarists, is that the central bank is the cause of inflation, and that high inflation rates can be brought down with tighter monetary policy in the form of a reduction in the growth rate of the money supply. They were frequently told they were wrong, that inflation was different this time, that the normal tools would not work, that monopolies and labor unions and oil cartels were to blame. Yet when Paul Volcker took over as chair of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, he explicitly placed responsibility for creating inflation on the Federal Reserve. Contractionary monetary policy, as evident in the significant declines in the growth of the money supply, brought down the rate of inflation. The dire predictions of the critics failed to materialize, and discussion of the role of unions and monopolists in the inflation process largely disappeared. Low, stable rates of inflation continued over the next quarter century. This stability was not due simply to luck. It was also not due to the Federal Reserve getting better at fighting inflation. Instead, the evidence suggests that the stability over this quarter century was due to the change in Federal Reserve doctrine brought about by Volcker and the acceptance of the view that the central bank is the inflation creator. Despite this evidence, the old inflation fighter arguments are beginning to reemerge, which is why it is important to recall the lessons from these old debates. Central banks are not passive observers of inflation that just do their best to keep it in check. Central banks are the source of inflation. As such, the responsibility for maintaining low, stable rates of inflation is theirs. All right, and that wraps up our piece by Joshua R. Hendrickson, an associate professor at the University of Mississippi. I mean, there's a little bit of about the author on related to like things he's focused on related to monetary theory, history, policy, and the political economy of Bitcoin. I don't know his work. Like I said, I don't know his work very well. But this one just stood out to me because of the title, and it got me reading through this piece. And I thought this would be good to cover because there's some things that I agree with and there's some things that I disagree with. So, or I guess premises in the conversation or in the way this is described that I disagree with. So let's hit our sponsor really quick and then we'll get into a guy's take. Have you guys used the Swan Bitcoin app before? I'm not sure. I don't think I've talked about it much, but the Swan app basically has everything you need to get onboarded and manage very easily and very simply your automatic savings policy, your automatic withdrawals. And it's specifically how I keep up with the market analysis, with their blog and the things that are going on, and get like access to all of their resources and stuff. I pretty much manage everything through the app now, or at least it's my daily go-to. And I just realized that I haven't really talked about it much. Swan Bitcoin is not only the best onboarding service in the Bitcoin space, but it's the one that is going to teach you how to protect yourself. It will teach you how to protect yourself from exchanges, from scammers, and from even having risk with Swan Bitcoin. They're one of the only services that I know of that aggressively teach you and tell you how to withdraw and make it so that you can do this automatically, so that you can buy Bitcoin automatically and automatically withdraw to your keys. That is what I do, and it is a godsend. I never have to worry about being exposed because I know exactly how much I allow to be in there before they automatically send it to my keys on my cold card in my cold storage, and it is safe in my possession. That is hard to beat. And if the place that you get Bitcoin is trying to encourage you to trade and not telling you that you need to withdraw and helping you to hold your own keys and knowing how to protect yourself, then it's not a service you should be using, and you should go to swanbitcoin.com/guy right now and sign up. Check them out. So, the author's other work, I noticed specifically Bitcoin, and I don't remember who recommended this for me. Whoever it was, I appreciate it. This was a good one to read, and I think it's a good one for a couple of different reasons. It's good to see. Like, this is kind of, I kind of think of this as like the mainstream, like the academia debate, is that there is actually a pushback to make it clear that the central bank is the cause of inflation. But what's funny is that the premise of what inflation is and whether or not it's a negative in general is not attacked. Like, and I think this is a great example of how the reality can get lost because everybody is arguing at a different level. Essentially, they're arguing too high up the stack of the reality of what's going on. Like, one of the things that he points out that I thought was really interesting, and that Austrian economics specifically attacks or addresses when laying out the foundation of how to think about the consequences of economic changes and monetary policy and these things, is the idea of counterfactuals. So he says, quote, "Counterfactuals are difficult. A counterfactual requires comparing what happened to what would have happened. Because one does not know what would have happened, one needs economic models, concepts, and analysis." Now, Austrian economic theory addresses this same thing and says that you can't make a model that says what would have happened, because you're dealing in the quote-unquote science, you're dealing in the study of human behavior. And essentially the only way, the most critical thing that you have to go back to in order to make any understanding of what has happened is an a priori principle. You need to understand the reality that all of this is based on. And if you're not coming from that position, from that standpoint, then you're not looking at what's happening. Like, a good example is the idea that there should be some sort of stable inflation target. Now, it doesn't appear that Joshua is ever actually arguing this in the piece, but it's almost just taken as a given that this should be the case. And maybe it's just, you know, we're leaving this to another article or another research report or something like that, and you know, he's not trying to get into something that would require its own lengthy explanation. But what does it mean to have 2% inflation, even if that is the central banker's target? For some reason, it means that 2% of our proportion of the economic output that we contributed to has been stolen. It's a network. Money is a network. And to hold a portion of that, to hold a piece of the pie of that network that says that is your record of what you have put into the world. So the analogy I always use is that, you know, if you save a dollar every time you make a sandwich, and we're working in a ridiculously hilarious fantasy land of where dollars are just a single explicit money supply that doesn't change. But if you save a dollar every time you make a sandwich and serve a sandwich to someone else, and you save $1 million, understand that's 1 million sandwiches that you have made for other people. You have cooked, you have cut, you have cleaned, you have fashioned, you have served 1 million meals for other people. And you have eaten nothing. in the context of that, obviously you ate something along the lines or you would have died, but in the context of the $1 million that you have saved, those are explicitly tallying, keeping a record of the output that you didn't consume. It's the million meals you are owed that you never ate. You are still sitting on the proof that you did it in the past so that you can get it back from the economy. A 2% inflation rate is just stealing what you already did from you. It's just making money not do its job of transporting across time the things you've done in the past. The value you have contributed to the economic system which owes you back. That's what it is. It is a record of what everyone else has consumed and owes you. Again, in a fantasy world of a sound money supply and no political money printing. Or, well, maybe a better example is in the world of Bitcoin. But one thing this report does is it doesn't distinguish between monetary inflation and consumer price inflation. And I think that's a problem because it only ends up, it really does confuse. I almost hate that they are the same word, that it's inflation, price inflation, and monetary inflation. Because price inflation, take out anything with the monetary policy, prices adjust all the time. Prices are meant to adjust to reflect reality. So a good example is that if the money supply stayed the same and a nuclear bomb was dropped on the country, you're basically eviscerating half of the economic network of output. The productivity, it might be way, actually a crap ton worse than that, probably like a 90% drop in the output. And what would happen is the relative prices of everything would skyrocket. But that's not inflation. That's a serious, sudden, disastrous decline in output, in supply. And this is one of the only ways you can have sustained, broad, across the board, everything goes up in price, is if everything gets scarce. But the idea that, like, random costs are going up or greedy corporations are causing it is so nonsensical. Like, and all you have to do is have an a priori foundation as to what money is and how it relates to everything else in the economy to know that it's absolute nonsense. And this goes back to my issue of counterfactuals, is that you can't imagine your control in an experiment. You can't just make up a different scenario, and you can't come up with a model. If your model can't predict the future today, then it certainly can't predict the future of a different path in the multiverse or whatever the hell. You can't go back in time and predict a different future with your model that can't predict anything. You can't. If we could predict the future, don't you think this situation would be a lot easier? Wouldn't we have seen this coming if any of those models make any sense? And it's so funny because people accuse, and I was just arguing not too long ago with somebody who just, oh, the pain. Talking about how, you know, Mises and Hoppe talk about that Austrian economics is unfalsifiable. And that is not their argument. It's that the principles that they build their arguments from are unfalsifiable because they are a priori realities. They are things about the universe that we can know for certain. 2 + 2 = 4. There's no world in which that equals 5. And if you are discussing an economic theory in which 2 + 2 = 5 because you have some empirical evidence, what you need to be doing is looking at what you are unable to see that is confusing you, because 2 + 2 doesn't = 5. It equals 4. You can't eat an apple and also have that same apple later for another meal. There are very basic things that we know for certain about reality that are true, and the more confusing and millions and billions of interactions and people and money and interest rates and GDP that you stack on top of it doesn't make it not true. So if your supposed result of economics, of your economic understanding, your economic model, is that you can have your apple and eat it right now, then it's wrong. And that reality is unfalsifiable because it's based on the fact that you can't eat something and still have the thing. And yet this is kind of how Keynesian economics goes. And now going back to inflation, there's a lot of different reasons why prices can go up and down, and there's also a lot of different ways that money is actually created in the system. Like, so there's the traditional way that there's just huge expansionary policy by the government and the central bank, right? The government, they're just issuing money into existence to, you know, fund the political apparatus, and then it's pushing money out into the economy, or it's buying corporate bonds, or it's buying government bonds, whatever it is. It's creating new units, which is creating new reserves, and then you have the fractional reserve version, where they actually issue money as loans to consumers at some sort of an interest rate. This is the actually somebody was mentioning it today. I forget what it's called because it's based on a thing from like a long time ago. Wait, it's the Mandrake mechanism. But it's based off a comic actually, or a cartoon or something of some sort. And it was a magician who would make things appear and then disappear. And it's alluding to, the reason it got started getting called that, it was alluding to the fact that the fractional reserve system, or basically the banking system in general, issues new money. So when you go to get like a mortgage or something, let's say you get a $200,000 loan for a mortgage to buy a house, they issue that money into existence, and then you pay them interest on something that never existed. You pay them interest on money they never earned, on money they never saved, on money that no one ever saved. It's literally just issued. I mean, think about how great that deal is. That I could have no money at all, and I could just issue you a loan to buy a house, and then you owe me a mortgage. You just have to pay me. I have a monthly income now. That creates money in the system. And that's what leads to the steady long-term inflation of the system, because more debt is constantly being created. And it's also why a tighter monetary policy can cause heavy disinflation or deflation in the money, because you can wipe out loans. And when those loans are paid off, the interest all goes to the bank as new money that just is now just the banks. But the original loan gets deleted. So you're actually looking at a place where a system where the monetary supply can shrink drastically, purely through the manipulation of the interest rate, or of course, grow rapidly. But ultimately, it is because they judge the rate at which new money is being created in the system. It's still causing a bloat and a transfer of value, a transfer of real resources from the population to the banking and financial sector. That's the thing. The creation of new money, the counterfeiting of money, is a cheat, no matter what way you do it, no matter how you twist it, no matter what you name it, no matter what system or policy you put underneath it, it's theft. It's cheating the accounting system rather than producing resources. Again, this is something I mentioned a couple of times recently, but one of the core concepts of money is that you can't make more of it, or that it's so hard to make more of it that you don't do that. Instead, you actually produce things in the economy to acquire money. So rather than trying to go out and issue new money or create new money or dig new money out of the ground, what do? You make a service. You provide a product. You help someone out. You make a sandwich. You do those other things because they are easier than obtaining new units of money, which is just a mechanism of cheating the record of who has done the actual stuff, the resources, the sandwiches, built the houses, made the cars, etc. That's what money is supposed to do. It's supposed to keep a record of those things so that we know who we owe back to keep the thing running. Because the people who are building it, who are making the sandwiches and serving the food and building the houses need to be rewarded, or they will stop doing it for other people. The economy will grind to a halt if money does not keep the record of what they have done and what they are owed, because no one will be able to trade. No one will be able to sustain their life by producing goods and resources for other people and never getting them back. Why would you ever do that? Why would you go out and catch food and give it to someone else if you couldn't get it back? Well, if you incentivize a system that makes it so no one wants to do that for any service or good or resource, Well, then you don't have an economy. You have a bunch of people scrambling desperately to get their own survival in order at while doing no trade and no exchange for anyone else except the bare minimum to get by at this very moment and living hand to mouth. How do we know that's the result? Hyperinflation. We see it. It happens a lot. Fiat currencies do this every couple of years. That is the state of no economic communication. That is the state of a bad money. And a money with 2% inflation is just a less bad money. But going back to the idea of price increases, this is something that I can't believe. I say this a lot, but I can believe it because this is how people are. But the fact that inflation, the very nature of a central bank is that it has one tool. It can manipulate the interest rate or it can create money. And both of these are kind of two sides of the same coin, right? They use both mechanisms to accomplish the same task. But they're both just ways of creating price controls. And they are also just kind of an obscured way to create price controls by not directly controlling the price. But if you ask any legitimate economist, not a politician, but somebody who actually has at least a little bit of a head on their shoulders, knows that price controls don't work. Basic supply and demand curve stuff, Econ 101, without a doubt, price controls don't work. Interest rate controls are just flat price controls, and money manipulation to result in interest rate controls are just price controls with an extra step. And again, we go back to some of our a priori principles here that we can understand is that we can't create resources out of thin air by just writing down numbers on pieces of paper or punching in numbers in a spreadsheet. Nothing shows up in the world when you do that. All you're doing is somehow, somewhere on this spreadsheet, allocating someone else to consume resources that did not previously go about the economic process of creating and obtaining those spreadsheet points legitimately in order to get that record, in order to get that right to consume. All it can do is shift resources from one place to another. And when we're talking about the interest rate and we're talking about debt, all it can do is shift resources that are saved for later to be consumed now. And those can also have price adjustments or price consequences. For example, if you cause quote-unquote economic activity by loosening monetary policy, even without expanding a massive amount of debt and new money into the system, what you can do is entice and or force force economic actors or normal consumers who have saved resources to spend those saved resources today. But all you're doing is taking demand from the future and moving it back to today. You don't create any new one. There's no net increase. All you've done is made people spend frugally and in a frivolous, thoughtless manner because prices aren't reflecting reality and aren't telling us what the reality of our future is going to be and the scarcity that we are going to have to deal with. So we're throwing away resources and overconsuming rather than saving them for the future because the price of the future has been lied about. Again, not really inflation, just a price rise that is caused by diverting resources that are saved for the future, for an uncertain future, and making us use and consume them today, even though we would not have naturally done that. That is what causes a debt bubble. It's just with debt, you can get people to, rather than even getting people to spend their savings, you can basically confiscate those savings by issuing new money and letting the people with debt consume those resources. And then what you've actually done is you've tricked the saver into thinking they still have their saved money, but you've diluted them out of their proportion of the economic network. So their slice of the pie is smaller, and what they contributed to the pie is not what they are now able to eat. They have been cheated. The record system has been cheated, such that they lost their resources and someone else was able to consume them. But in the context of manipulating the price of time by getting people to consume and invest and do things today that they were saving resources for the future to accomplish, all you do is create a bubble of activity. And it's why on the surface it appears, and they have their models and their empirical evidence that it causes a boom in activity. Well, of course it does. Because I was saving money for next year's harvest, or I was saving seeds for next year's harvest, and you just incentivized me to eat them today. Looks great. Right now, I have twice as much food as I usually do because I just ate all my seeds, but I have no harvest for next year. There's a really great analogy that I like, but I don't want to go into it because I just don't have enough time. We'll probably cover it at some point. Anyway, we have a lot of episodes. is about an analogy to make sense of the resources versus the money. And my brother actually came up with the analogy, and I kind of took it and ran with it and turned it into this whole thing to explain the boom and bust cycle. But it's like comparing cars to the number of keys. And a bank takes in 100 cars from 100 different people. And because they're pretty sure not everyone is always going to need their cars, well, they can sell a couple of extra keys, maybe 140 keys. And they can just be certain that they'll always have a few extra cars in the garage, in the bank, that someone isn't using. But what happens when the car itself, you don't actually need the utility of the car, you're just trading the keys? Well, what happens, and just like in the boom and bust cycle, is people start making tons of plans, starting projects, and trying to accomplish tasks that need cars, that they cannot complete without having access to a car, but they've got the key, so they're certain. They're accepting this as proof that they have access to a car. But one day, so many projects get created that, and so many people go and try to start getting the cars out of the banks because they need them for their vacation, for their trip, for, you know, to move, to transport their resources or their products or whatever it is, and there's just not enough cars. And then suddenly, a project that was going to get finished now can't get finished because everybody else is using up all of the cars. But they had the keys. They had the keys to start the project. That is what it's like to issue debt into existence and create an economic boom that eventually results in a massive collapse because it's not a real boom. You're using resources, or you're expecting to be able to finish these projects with resources that don't actually exist. You're being lied to about the economic reality. So the episode, it was a guy's take episode that I covered this in extensive detail. Pretty sure it was called like A Story of Booms and Bust. It was an early one. It's been a while. But I'll link to it. I'll link to it in the show notes if you want to check it out. But anyway, I like this piece. I like the title of this piece, which kind of got me interested in it. And I read it and I thought it was good just because it hit a couple of topics. Like I said, I think it's a good view of the mainstream perspective, and I think it gives a pretty good framing to make sense of how the Austrian theory or the Austrian perspective differs, because essentially they both allow themselves room to deny some basic, very fundamental thing about reality because they're trying to create some model to establish a control experiment, or control for their experiment to compare to, which simply can't be done. Which means that economics is not so much, it's not the study of GDP, it's not how to develop a model or a math problem for one industry or one sector of the economy. The goal of economics, or the quest of economics, is the study and understanding of human behavior and human actions in the face of scarcity, derived from or deduced from reality, from fundamental truths that we know cannot be denied. And when the Austrian theorists say that it's unfalsifiable, what they are saying is that the first principles that you build it from are unfalsifiable. There is no argument that 2 + 2 = 5. There is no argument that you can consume a thing and still own it. But if you were to falsify Austrian economics, you need to deduce that the understanding of human behavior, the understanding of the mechanisms of economics, produce a different result. But if you were countering or contradicting the fundamental reality that we know, well, then you're not doing economics. You're just making up a fantasy land in which the puzzle pieces fit together because you don't understand anything about the economy. Anyway, fun article, fun little or research paper. I'm not even sure it was a PDF. I'll have the, I think the link is still active. One of these disappeared on me at some point. But I'll have the link to it if you want to check it out. And if you want to check out the other things that author does, I'm actually going to be kind of digging through and seeing what Joshua Hendrickson does. Because I do also want to say that I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Joshua, because he's not, he hasn't really made some of the arguments that I've kind of assumed, or the premises. His argument here was that the Federal Reserve is an inflation creator. And from a monetary standpoint, that's fundamentally true. And in the context of his analogy of whether or not the, if, you know, the inflation is a fire and the Federal Reserve is the Federal Reserve the arsonist, or is it the firefighter? And 100%, it is only the arsonist. It can only be the arsonist, and its only tool is matches. The best thing, the only thing that the Federal Reserve can do is stop causing more fire. When they are fighting inflation, quote unquote, all they are doing is trying to correct the interest rate. They are trying to correct the monetary policy and trying to contract the expansion such that it is where the market would actually indicate the truth of the economy, which means they're trying to price control to what the market price would do for free, which begs the question, why are we controlling the price if we're trying to guess what the market is trying to tell us when the market does that for free perfectly, and all we have is the market to go by for the information on how to even figure out what the market price might be. We have a pretty circular problem when we're using monetary prices to determine what the right monetary price is. I mean, like, how are we even determining what the interest rate ought to be? We're judging by relative prices in other markets, which we know because the market action and market actors in the actual situations in the exchange who actually earned the money and have skin in the game and present, or they make a stake of the value of every exchange, are giving information to them through the market. In other words, the only place that they can get the information is the same place they are trying to manipulate to get a specific result out of. But there is a simple, fundamental, undeniable truth. The Federal Reserve, the central bank, creates more money. More money, chasing the same number of goods, causes price inflation. And because any amount of money that you have is a proportion of the whole of the monetary supply, it's a proportion of the economic output that you are owed, well then if the money supply does not increase, the only way for sustained price increases to happen in any particular sector is for demand to shift from some other sector, in which prices would go down. But anyway, I want to close this one out with just my favorite, with the line that I read that is what convinced me to read this on the show and just kind of have a fun episode on it. Because I think this completely shuts down. Not only are there 100 different reasons and fundamental logic to make the idea that inflation is because of greedy corporations and monopolies, which just fundamentally makes no sense. But despite that, I thought this was a really fun retort. So here's the quote. It says, "All of this is important because there has been a resurrection of Burns-type's position in the current debate about the cause of higher inflation rates. Senator Elizabeth Warren blames the rising inflation on greedy corporations raising their prices. Others have blamed rising prices on the greater prevalence of monopolies. Antitrust is apparently an anti-inflation tool. Make no mistake, these ideas are wrong. A belief that greed is responsible for inflation requires a belief that firms waited 40 years to collectively and simultaneously raise prices, an amazing level of planning and discipline." I thought that was a great retort, and you know, it completely begs the question, is why are we even trying to figure out what monetary, like, why do we even investigate if it's just greed? If it's just greed, then we know, like, greed is a constant. If you ever hear a politician or an economist say that, like, animal spirits or greed or sexism or something like that causes this huge economic shift or outcome or inflation or whatever it is, understand that they're saying nothing, or at least nothing of any economic relevance or importance, because they're talking about things that are simply static. They're simply elements of the environment. If greed exists, then people are just greedy. We're talking about something about human behavior. It's not something that, like, is like nobody really engages in for 20 years and then suddenly everybody's greedy. The question is, why did behavior change? If you're just saying that greed caused it, that's like saying gravity caused the plane to crash. It's like, okay, well, let's investigate a little bit further because maybe something else went wrong. That's not telling us anything about the plane crash. We all knew that the plane was going to fall and plummet to the ground if its wings didn't work, if it didn't have a working engine, if there were no fuel, if pieces of the plane started to break off. The question is, which one of those things stopped working to cause gravity to take over? So if someone tells you that greed causes inflation, I promise you they are trying to sell you something, or they just want more power. They want to be in charge of the stick that punishes the quote-unquote greed as they subjectively define it, so that they can beat the world into the shape that they think it ought to be. So that'll do it. thank you guys for listening. I really did actually enjoy this, even though my guy's take kind of sounds like I'm arguing with it a lot. But a good piece. I will definitely be checking out Joshua Hendrickson for kind of digging into whatever else they are writing on, because now I'm curious. And thank you to whoever suggested this one to me. Also, thank you to everyone who has been supporting me on Fountain. Not only is it awesome to be headed towards the top of the leaderboards, I think it was like number 8 the last time I saw, but it's also good to know Linux Unplugged is not up there. How does it feel, guys? How does it feel? The Bitcoiner's taking your throne. And guess what? It's GIF. It ain't GIF, it's GIF. Suck it. But anyway, I just wanted to thank the amazing crew on Fountain that are supporting the show and boosting and getting Bitcoin Audible up in the ranks. And also thank you for the comments. I don't have enough time to go through all of them from the last couple of days, but I will be getting back to them on other episodes. I'm just kind of out of time tonight. So we will come back to it. And also a huge thank you to Swan Bitcoin, the best onboarding service for Bitcoiners everywhere, to CoinKite for the best hardware devices, for keeping your Bitcoin safe and keeping your cold storage the coldest with the cold card, and Fold, the sats back on everything in your fiat life card that you just should not be without. And 50,000 free sats over there. Don't forget about it. All right. I will catch you on the next one. Thank you guys so much for listening. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. The most important thing to remember is that inflation is not an act of God, that inflation is not a catastrophe of the elements or a disease that comes like a plague. Inflation is a policy. Ludwig von Mises.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.